Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. There's that old belief that history helps you understand where we're going in the future. And in the wake of the 2008 financial meltdown, Chris Katarna, who is a politics scholar at Oxford and also co-author of the book Age of Discovery, he was looking all around him, he saw upheaval everywhere, and what he couldn't figure out was whether there was a period in history that would be a helpful parallel that might indicate both what was ahead and then what kinds of mistakes we should try to avoid. Then, on a trip to Italy, Katarna found the parallel he'd been looking for, the Renaissance.
And I went to see Michelangelo's David at the Accademia Gallery in Florence. Just a work of art I'd always wanted to see. Actually, my mother and my father had gone on their honeymoon to Florence. And she had brought back as a souvenir a 2-foot replica of David, which had stood on my fireplace growing up as a kid.
You had the mini David, and now you're seeing the real
David
thing.
And I had the mini David, which is, you know, far more impressive in a lot of ways. But, you know, what was fascinating, being in that room, looking at the original, is the inspiration behind Michelangelo's David. Because, you know, unlike pretty much every representation in painting or sculpture that had been done before, you know, all of those previous representations, they showed David in his moment of victory over Goliath. But Michelangelo, he carved David in his moment of decision. You know, when he recognized this contest, recognized his opportunity to shape the wider war by going into single combat with this giant foe and making that decision to do it. And of course, Michelangelo carved that because he wanted the people who would be present in the square at its unveiling to recognize that was the moment that they were in, that what we call the Renaissance, for those who lived through it, was actually the time of flourishing genius and also risk and upheaval.
And so that this feels to you like a moment of extraordinary risk. I mean, that must be what you're saying, because, boy, a lot of time has passed between the Renaissance and now. And so this must seem to you a period of extraordinary risk if you have to go back 600 years to find a parallel.
It is a moment, an extraordinary moment. You know, not only of risk, fundamentally, our message is that this moment is a contest between extraordinary risk and also extraordinary genius and really civilizational gains. I mean, the positive story is that this is absolutely the best moment in history to be born, you know, by macro measures of health and wealth. And education. I mean, when you look at life expectancy gains and literacy and even wealth, I mean, although we have massive issues with distribution, any previous civilization at its height would gladly trade places with us and believe that they could solve the problems because there's just so much more abundance. So it is also a tremendously positive moment, but our openness and our connectedness, our rapidly changing economies and technologies have also tangled us together, made us more vulnerable to one another. And the gap there has left us open to dramatic dangers.
Well, and one of the dangers that you've pointed to is the one posed by global warming, which science has tried very hard to bring our attention to. And certainly in the Renaissance, you had Copernicus, who was advocating for also a fundamental shift in people's views, the idea that the Earth goes around the sun and then the sun does not actually go around the Earth. And both of those ideas, those concepts in their own eras, are big mental shifts.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that's a terrific parallel that you're making, and one that I've been making as well. I mean, in the book, we make several predictions sort of about where this moment is headed, what are the risks that we face. I really feel that climate change is our Copernican moment. And what I mean by that is, because what's interesting about Copernicus is so he does this study of the sky, and he's dissatisfied with Ptolemy's model of the heavens. And so he comes up with his own that is more accurate. And it really is out of a desire to improve his understanding of the heavens, that he says, you know, look, I just think the best way to improve it is to flip the model. But it was such a gigantic shift that most people could not accept it, could not accept the new reality that he was painting for people. And it really took European society 100 years until Galileo came along, until telescopes came along, and you could amass more direct evidence that what Copernicus had theorized was actually true. And I really think that that's our struggle right now with climate change. I mean, it is a vastly complicated area of science. And yet, I think that, you know, there's really no serious doubt left in the scientific community that humanity has a profound impact on the climate. And a lot of what we're seeing is anthropogenic. The challenge is that the implications of that reach so deep into how we currently structure our societies and the individual choices that we make. You know, for example, I just flew back from Canada to the UK. There's a cost.
There's
a climactic consequence of my air travel. But how can I, right? So it is so difficult for us to grasp that we have a terribly hard time really bringing the scientific realization to the level of penetrating our behaviors. And it's interesting that, you know, we think that 500 years on, we are far more rational species, far more open to shaping our behaviors around the revelations of science. In some cases, that may not be true.
Right. Well, you know, another way in which maybe we have not changed so much since the Renaissance is our response to charismatic leaders and a kind of tendency towards populism. So have you, studying what you've been studying, looking back for 500 years, have you been surprised about the rise of those same sorts of people now and how much success they've met with? And it's not just people. So Brexit, for example, of course, has a populist component to it.
I mean, I think the honest answer is yes and no. With Brexit, interestingly, my co-author and I, we actually publicly in the British press, we predicted that the result would be for the UK to vote to leave the EU. That was a very unpopular prediction, let me say, in the time that we made it. But one of the great gifts of looking back in history is that it stretches our imagination. And with Brexit, we were really thinking hard about what had happened in the first Renaissance and what could happen in this, our second, and thinking about the Protestant Reformation. Next year is the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther famously banging his theses against indulgences on the doors of his church in Wittenberg. And, you know, if you went back 500 years and you surveyed people in the streets of Brussels or London, and you asked them, you know, how likely do you think it is that next year a priest who you've never heard of is going to launch this political and religious revolution that's going to break Europe in half, Europe's ultimate establishment power, right, into Catholic and Protestant halves, is going to spark a century of continental disintegration. I mean, people would just look at you like you're mad.
Right.
They could not imagine it. And that is precisely the mistake that British Prime Minister David Cameron made back in 2013 when he offered the British public an EU referendum in exchange for their vote. I mean, he just could not imagine that the status quo would not endure.
Well, yes, and it also goes back to that power of populism and the power of people feeling like they're going up against the power brokers. But as you say, there is real potential for populism and for religion to go awry and yes, to mobilize people, but not necessarily in a constructive way.
I think one of the best examples of that, of sort of the dark side of religion, of its potential to wage terror, is the Bonfire of the Vanities, which was led by a monk in Italy, Girolamo Savonarola. And here is a man who he was essentially a political outsider, and he put his hands on the power of religion to stoke fear, and he spread a message of, you know, of Armageddon, sort of the year 1500 was approaching, and it was a, you know, he gave this apocalyptic message about what was going to happen.
Oh, did he think that the world was going to end in 1500 or something was going to happen in that moment?
There was going to be a new flood.
Okay.
Because he felt that, you know, Florence was famously liberal, licentious. God was offended. And if they did not reform their ways, then God was going to send a new flood to purify them. And, you know, what's interesting for Savonarola is that the times cooperated. You know, there was Ottoman Turks harassing Italy from the east. Mm-hmm. Charles from France invaded Italy from the west. And, you know, so people believe that in a certain way he had predicted it all.
Right.
He gained enormous power. He managed to kick the Medici out of Florence, which was no mean feat.
Mm-hmm.
And he reconstituted what had been an extremely liberal society as the Christian and religious Republic of Florence. And he began a campaign of persecution against anyone who didn't share his moral code that culminated with the bonfire of the Vanities. And there's a lot of parallels there to what ISIS has managed to achieve in Syria and Iraq, and stepping into an extremely unstable society with a message of, you know, how we are going to leverage the technology of these days and leverage the sense of the coming apocalypse all around us to bind together and to realize, you know, a purer expression of our religious values or our religious creed than has ever been possible in the past.
And what happens? I mean, what happened when you are able to convince a society or a city, adopt this new way of being, be more absolutist, you know, be more, as you say, kind of less libertine and more conservative, not politically, but sort of morally? What happened?
Right. I mean, well, so what happened in Savonarola's case is that reality intervened. You see, a lot of people who supported him believed his message that the apocalypse was coming. And when it didn't come, then a lot of his magic, if you will, his authority went away.
Mm-hmm.
And then people started to ask questions about, well, what about our practical concerns?
Right.
You know, what about our jobs? You know, what about disease in our city? How are you dealing with those? And when they began to realize that he didn't have the governance skill to actually help people solve the real practical issues that determine their well-being, he very quickly lost his authority.
Mm.
He was, I mean, in Savonarola's case, he was, I mean, ultimately, he was ultimately crucified.
Yikes.
In the very same square where he lit his historic bonfire. Ultimately, reality is hard to reject, and healthy societies are those that build atop it rather than in defiance to it.
Well, I wonder if you see us behaving differently than people behaved in the Renaissance. Because as you said, you know, here's Martin Luther nailing these 95 theses to the wall. And what ensues? Like people being burned at the stake, you know, decades and centuries of people hating each other because of religion. I mean, it was not necessarily pretty where they went in this time of upheaval. How do we get around that? And are there any signs that we are going to avoid the ugliness of what happened in the Renaissance?
Mm. Well, you asked me all the easy questions.
That's right. I thought I'd just throw some softballs and you can tell us what to do.
Now you come at the curve, the fastball. So far, I think we see a lot of the parallels to that same ugliness. I mean, classically, after amidst the Protestant Reformation, there was a lot of nastiness. I mean, there was the largest migration of peoples that Europe had ever seen since the fall of the Roman Empire and until World War I, as, you know, communities forcibly reshuffled
mm-hmm.
one another into Catholic and Protestant halves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we voted you out, so you should leave,
right.
Which is a sad parallel to some of the nastier rhetoric that you're seeing, say, on the streets of London in the aftermath
mm-hmm.
of Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it really, I think, becomes a question to us about, you know, what kind of society do we want to build? And I really do believe, and, you know, in sort of the last part of the book, we talk about virtue as really one of the keys. You know, virtues are tremendously powerful. You know, it's interesting, just as an aside, so here in Oxford, one of our research groups looks at obesity. And how do you treat obesity? It turns out that the most reliable way is to take a person who suffers from obesity and put them into a healthy community. And they sort of adopt through osmosis the virtue of a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, the power of sort of the peer group to make you negative or make you positive or whatever.
Because you know, human nature has a lot of darknesses and a lot of appetites. We rely upon society to overlay that with healthier habits and practices. It is certainly possible to overlay us individually with an appreciation for diversity, with the belief that through diversity we become stronger as a people rather than turning against each other. It is certainly possible to establish these positive myths over ourselves, but they are very fragile, and that's what worries me personally, sort of as we look at a lot of the political rhetoric unfolding across the developed world today, is that as soon as political leaders stand up and invoke rhetoric of anger and hatred and oversimplifying problems by laying them on the shoulders of people who look different or have a different background, as soon as we rebrand civility as political correctness and call political correctness something bad, I mean, we go down a very dangerous road.
Chris Katarna is author of Age of Discovery, Navigating the Risks and Rewards of Our New Renaissance. He's also a fellow at the Oxford Martin School. Chris, thank you so much for this discussion.
It has been my absolute pleasure.
Find our stories in iTunes and SoundCloud. And if you catch us on iTunes, you can write a review and let us know what you think. And you can let us know if there's something you'd like to hear more of on the show. From PRI and WGBH Radio, I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.